Kia ora and welcome to all of you that are listening in today to this South Pacific Weather Training Telecast Lecture. My name is Jane Barnett and it's great that you can join us for today's lecture, which I know that we're all going to be looking forward to. Today's speaker is Tony Ward, who's a paediatric infectious disease specialist from here in Canterbury in New Zealand. So a good local lecturer for us today. He trained at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London and then worked as an ID consultant at the Sydney Children's Hospital before coming to work at the University of Otago here in Canterbury. Research interests include the impact of pneumococcal vaccine in New Zealand, the safety of Tdap in pregnant women, and surveillance of rotavirus pre and hopefully post-vaccine introduction. He is currently on the Immunisation Technical Forum, the advisory group to the New Zealand Ministry of Health on vaccines. So it's really great that you're able to deliver today's lecture, Tony. Thank you very much for contributing to the Weather Training Telecast. So I'll hand over to you.
Lovely. Thank you, Jane. Thanks for the introduction. And thank you both you and Paul for the invitation to speak. This is a topic that's kind of dear to my heart. I remember as a boy training in paediatrics a few years ago, meningococcal disease was the thing that really struck me as a terrifying disease which attacked many children very quickly, made them become very sick very quickly. And at the time, we really had nothing in the way of prevention strategies to prevent children becoming sick. So I guess it was one of the diseases that really got me interested in infectious diseases and subsequently in vaccines and how to prevent infectious diseases. So I've chosen sort of vaccines for meningococcal disease as the subject of my talk today for a couple of reasons, really. Firstly, it has a strong connection to New Zealand, who, and as we go through, I'll show for those of you who are not familiar with recent epidemics in New Zealand, what's been happening there, but also there's a lot of new innovations globally in terms of preventing meningococcal disease and an interesting and exciting future in terms of the vaccines that may be available and coming onto the market in the coming years. So if you just go on to the next slide, I've listed an outline of what I'm going to talk about. For those of you who aren't especially familiar with meningococcal disease, I'll talk a little bit about the clinical features that we see in children. Predominantly children. I'm a paediatrician, so I'll be focusing on the children's disease. I'll talk a little bit about the epidemiology in a global sense and then move on to talk a little bit about meningococcal epidemic in New Zealand, a little bit about meningococcal disease elsewhere in the world, and then focus in on specific vaccines that were used in New Zealand during the recent epidemic, vaccines for African population and some of the new conjugate meningococcal vaccines that are coming onto the market. So some of you may not be familiar with meningococcal disease, so I thought I would just start out going over a little bit of what it involves with meningococcal disease in children. On the next slide you'll see a picture of a child, a New Zealand boy from a number of years ago now, and he's reasonably unwell and he has meningococcal sepsis. So meningococcal disease can have a wide range of presentations. Rarely you see children with what we call chronic meningococcal disease where they're not especially unwell but have bacteremia for a long period of time. A lot of children carry the organism in their nasopharynx and never end up becoming unwell. But what we fear is children who come through the door with a non-specific febrile illness, many times they'll have symptoms that are not especially specific to the disease and could fit with someone with influenza or any number of other viral infections. And occasionally they will progress quickly to septic shock and die. And equally as terrifying, sometimes children can have meningitis and complications that go with that. The disease affects younger children disproportionately. The highest rates of disease in any population are generally in infants younger than a year of age. And those children As anyone who works in paediatrics will know, are the hardest ones to recognise symptoms from. So many of the children come in with very non-specific complaints like vomiting or fever or just being non-specifically unwell. The boy in the picture, he as I said, looks pretty unwell. He's probably got a stiff neck, and he's got a purpuric or petechial rash over his entire body, which has developed over the space of an hour or two. The sequelae from meningococcal disease can be severe. In New Zealand, the mortality rate associated with invasive meningococcal disease is in the order of 5 or 6%, but reports elsewhere in the world put it up around 15%. So a large proportion of children, compared to some other diseases, die from this disease, and even in a setting where we have access to intensive care, it's still a high mortality rate. And those that survive, many of them get back to normal, but a significant proportion, somewhere between sort of 12 and 20%, will have long-term severe problems such as deafness or other neurological complications or problems with limb ischemia and need amputations and things. On the next slide, I've got a picture of up close of the purpuric or petechial rash. This child's rash probably started out as little pinprick points, and has expanded significantly to the point where they've got large bruises. And I suspect the child in the picture, though we don't see them, is probably pretty unwell at the time. Interestingly, before we had modern microbiological techniques, it was common practice to try and identify the organism from within these large bruises or purpural lesions. And if you were to inject some saline into those, slosh it around a little bit, pull it out, put it on the microscope slide and do a gram stain, you'd see gram-negative diplococci from those lesions. So these are embolic phenomena. They are the bacteria making their way through the bloodstream out into the skin and causing these ischemic lesions. And the worst case scenario with these is just on the next slide. I'm not trying to make this too gruesome, but you'll see a little baby who has developed some limb ischemia. And these purpuric lesions combined with septic shock and problems with coagulopathies can, in a small proportion, lead to limb ischemia and children losing fingers and toes and other parts of the limbs as well. So it's a deadly disease. It has severe manifestations which come along rapidly. And as I said, it's one of those things that as a paediatrician you are really in some ways scared of and really want to make sure that you don't miss when someone comes through the door. On the next slide, just a little bit about the organism and its carriage and transmission. There's an awful lot of people actually carry this organism in their nasopharynx. Not so many in the younger age groups. There's a lot of data suggesting that in infants and small children, the rate of carriage is low, less than sort of 1 or 2%. But as they get older, the rate of carriage becomes higher, and particularly high in adolescents and young people, and particularly in studies that have looked at young people who are heading off to university, and during their first year at university, the rates go much, much higher. Carriage is important because what we think happens in terms of developing meningococcal sepsis is that the organism will sort of set up shop on the person's nasopharynx and continue to thrive and grow there, and then at some stage will, prior to developing disease, will become invasive. Now that's the process that no one really understands. It's probably a quality of partly of the organism itself and partly of the environment and the nasopharynx, and it's been suggested that anything that adversely affects the normal flora or the host immune responses on the nasopharynx may contribute to this. Things like upper respiratory tract infections with viruses may precede infection, or smoking or may damage the nasal epithelium and lead to invasive disease. But the factors which cause that people really don't know. What we do know in terms of risk factors for disease are things like overcrowding in households with many people living in one room. The Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia, they are well known to have high rates of meningococcal disease associated with that. As I mentioned before, the rates of disease go up substantially in students who are attending university. And if you're exposed to Neisseria meningitis, and I guess this is important for people in hospital, so people who are in contact with someone who's got Neisseria meningitis disease, particularly close contact where you might have been in contact with someone who sneezed on you or people who have intubated a child, may be at higher risk of developing carriage themselves and therefore developing disease eventually. And that's the reason why people in close contact, we will often use prophylactic antibiotics to eliminate carriage in the nasopharynx. There are some specific immune deficiencies which put people at risk of the disease, particularly complement deficiencies. And if someone, very rarely happens, but occasionally people get meningococcal disease more than once, and in that situation it's really important that they are tested for an underlying immune deficiency. So the next thing I want to go on is talk about the epidemiology of meningococcal disease, both septicemia and meningitis, and look at it from a global perspective. So on the next slide, this is a table taken from an article this year in Vaccine, looking at sort of the global epidemiology. The first thing to note is down the left of this table, we've got different regions of the world, and beside that, their incidence of meningococcal disease per 100,000. You'll see, firstly, if we compare that to other bacterial diseases, say like pneumococcal disease, the rates are much lower than those. So for invasive pneumococcal disease prior to vaccination in many countries, the rates would be in some places up around 100 per 100,000, whereas for meningococcal disease, it's sort of, in most countries you'll see, is well below that, about 100 of that. So the actual incidence of disease compared to other bacterial infections is not high, but as I said before, the mortality can be much higher. The things to note, firstly, at the top of the list is the African meningitis belt, where they have had for many years had ongoing epidemics of meningococcal disease, and that'll form a reasonable part of this talk, where I'll go through some of the detail of what's been happening there and what we've done, well, what people have instigated in terms of preventing that disease with vaccines. The rest of it, you'll see the rates in comparison are really generally reasonably low over the years, but you'll see those of us in New Zealand will know that New Zealand has had higher rates of disease than many parts of the world, particularly parts of Europe and North America. So New Zealand for a long time has been sort of a hot spot of disease. I'll go on and talk about the epidemic in New Zealand, that 2.4 per 100,000 that's listed there for New Zealand in 2010 is a post-epidemic figure, and during the epidemic actually there was a lot of disease and much higher rates, somewhere up near what was going on in Africa. I put in the next slide just as a pretty picture of meningococcal disease. I had a professor once who taught me microbiology, who said he got into the business because he loved the pretty pictures on plates that bugs made, and now we've moved on to electron microscopy and things. I can kind of see what he means. So Neisseria meningitis is a gram-negative organism, and it appears in chains like this and often described as gram-negative cocci or diplococci, and I think you can see in the picture where you're getting two little balls sort of stuck together. But what I really want to show from this slide is they're all stuck together. The little cocci are stuck together by a polysaccharide capsule. They have a sticky outer coating, which is polysaccharide or sugars, which is important for their adhesion to each other, but also for important to sticking to surfaces in the nasopharynx and allowing them to replicate and allowing them to escape your body's immune responses. So that polysaccharide capsule is crucial. And if you go to the next slide, I've got a cartoon of the outer membranes and capsule of the meningococcus bug. You'll see the arrow there I've got on the left and the purple line all the way through. That's the polysaccharide capsule. And you'll see various different components of the organism attached to the outside, either going through or attached to this capsule. The polysaccharide capsule is really important, and that's why I introduced it early on in the talk. It's what we use to base the different types of meningococcus on, and I'll talk about the serogrouping shortly, but it's also the basis of most of the vaccines. So the people have looked at the polysaccharide capsule and looked at the immune responses, and in general people's immune responses are directed against things that are in or attached to the capsule. The other thing to note, just a couple of other things before we move on, because I'm going to come to them later in the talk. Firstly, the little blue spiky things that are labelled lipopolysaccharide are incredibly important. So they are not so much important for immune responses or vaccine responses, but very important in terms of the disease. That when you have an organism that is attacked by your immune system, the lipopolysaccharide can become free in the bloodstream, and it's what actually leads to septic shock and an overwhelming immune response from the body. So lipopolysaccharide is really the thing that causes the severe, acute, rapid onset of sepsis in people. The other thing just to notice is there's a number of membrane proteins that are spanning the polysaccharide capsule, and those are important because newer vaccines, which I'll come to later in the talk, have been shown to be have been developed based around those. So moving away from the polysaccharide, but moving towards proteins that are in the outer membrane. On the next slide, another pretty picture, another electron micrograph of Neisseria meningitidis. You think it wouldn't do much harm. It looks so pretty. This is about the serogroup. So when we talk about meningococcal disease, we really talk about dividing them up into serogroups, and as we'll see later, that's important because different countries have a predominance of serogroups in different countries. The serogrouping, as I said, is based around that polysaccharide capsule. The vast majority of infections are caused by just six of these serogroups. So A, B, C, W135, X, and Y. And at the moment, we have vaccines for all of these except X. And X, you'll see from some of the slides, doesn't cause a lot of disease. So if we move to the next slide, you'll see a little bit about the geographical distribution of the different serogroups. And I'll come back to the slide a couple of times during the talk because it's quite important. I might just start in the middle of the slide with Africa because that's where I'm going to start with the rest of the talk. And you'll see that serogroup A disease, causes most of the invasive disease in the African meningitis belt, almost exclusively. And B, C, and Y almost are never seen, and just a small proportion from W135 back in 2006. If you look to the Americas, you'll see there's type B and C are predominant, and actually there's very little group A disease anywhere else in the world. And then if you look to Europe, predominantly group B, Australia and New Zealand, predominantly, even more so, group B disease. So you can see if you're planning a global strategy for a vaccine against meningococcal disease, you'd really need to have something that covers multiple different serotypes. On to the next slide. I'm just going to talk about a little bit about meningococcal vaccines in general, and then I'll move on to talk a little bit, very briefly, about the immunology. You're safe because I'm not an immunologist, so I'll be just talking in very simplistic terms about my understanding of the immunology, but I think it is important when we're talking about vaccines to know a little bit about how they work and how they stimulate the immune system. So the meningococcal vaccines that we have at the moment are in general serogroup specific. So you have a vaccine which covers a specific serogroup, a vaccine for group A, a vaccine for group B, and vaccine for group C, and just very recently there's started to be combinations of those, but in general they've been serogroup specific vaccines. There are different sorts of vaccine. The earliest vaccines were polysaccharide vaccines, which were using that the components of that polysaccharide cell wall capsule to stimulate the body's immune system. And then more recently, there have been what we call protein polysaccharide conjugate vaccines, which provide a longer lasting immune response and in general a much better vaccine. So if we go on to the next slide, I'll sort of explain the immunology of those in a little bit of detail. So this is a cartoon from a paper by Andy Pollard from Oxford, which is just sort of explaining the differences between polysaccharide and conjugate vaccines. This is the polysaccharide vaccine to start with, and if you look up on the left, the top, you'll see the polysaccharide chain with those little balls with a line going through it. And that's what's presented in the vaccine to the body's immune response. The B cells in your body, which are those that go on and produce antibody, have on their surface a B cell receptor identified by BCR, which, if it's an exact match for the polysaccharide, binds to that polysaccharide and pretty much kicks the B cell into action. Once that happens, the B cell will transform itself into a plasma cell, and plasma cells are the cells that can produce antibody, and it's the antibody that mops up the bacteria and produces your immune response. So in someone who's had a vaccine, this process will take 24 hours or so to kick in, and the body will start producing antibodies from their plasma cells. The thing to note is that via this pathway, there's no production of long-standing memory B cells. So once you've been stimulated once or twice by the antigen again, you can actually run out of puff in terms of your vaccination potential. And so these polysaccharide vaccines are not long-lasting. An example of that would be a pneumococcal vaccine, polysaccharide vaccine, which we generally recommend that people get another shot of every 5 years, because the memory B cells aren't there. They don't have potential to continue to be producing antibodies, shall I say, as they go along. The other really important thing about these polysaccharide vaccines is listed at the bottom. Polysaccharide vaccines are poorly immunogenic in children less than 2 years of age. Remember I said that in children less than two have the highest rates of meningococcal disease. So actually, if you want a vaccine to protect the small ones, you've really got to have something that's a conjugate vaccine that will produce an antibody response to them. And on the next slide, we've got an example, again, another cartoon outlining the difference with a conjugate vaccine. So if we start at the top left again, there's a polysaccharide chain, but this time it's attached to a carrier protein. It's conjugated to a protein along with the polysaccharide. It interacts with the B cell receptor as in the previous slide, but this time, because of the carrier protein, the B cell internalizes this carrier protein, and that stimulates T cell involvement. At the bottom left, you can see a T cell, and the T cell basically ramps up the immune system response and enhances everything, makes it quicker, makes it sustained and more long-lasting. And so at the top right, you can see that the B cell is still stimulated to move to become a plasma cell and produce antibody. But in addition, there's an arrow going down to the bottom right-hand corner where a memory immune response, memory B cells are created. A memory immune response is created, and this is thought to be long-lasting. It means that if you are exposed to antigen again, or exposed to, in this case, Neisseria meningitis again, you can immediately produce a memory response because you have these memory B cells sitting there ready to produce antibody. And that's the big difference between a conjugate vaccine and a polysaccharide vaccine. And as I said, the conjugate vaccines seem to produce antibody even in infants as young as 6 weeks of age. So that's really why they're a much better sort of vaccine. All right. So I'm going to go through and talk about different meningococcal vaccines that are being used or about to be used around the world. And for want of a better approach, I've taken an alphabetical approach to them, and we're going to start with meningococcal A vaccine. So if you just move to the next slide, you'll recall that when we looked at the global map, serogroup A disease was something that was predominantly found in Africa, and in an area of Africa that has been termed for many years the African meningitis belt. And as you can see from that, so the Meningitis Vaccine Project logo, it's a belt of land that goes all the way across from one side to the other. The other point to make is that the burden of disease in Africa is phenomenally high, much higher than anywhere else in the world. Just as an example, between 2006 and 2008 in Burkina Faso alone, there were more than 45,000 cases of meningitis identified, an enormous number of people getting meningococcal disease. And at that time, more than 90% of those cases were due to meningococcal A, serogroup A. Now, previously, there have been vaccines that have been available to be used. They're almost exclusively polysaccharide vaccines. And the issue with those is by the time they're implemented, by the time there's been a rollout of vaccine, often the wave of disease has gone away. As we discussed previously, the immunity from the polysaccharide vaccines is generally very short-lasting. And so the effect of vaccination campaigns has never been substantial. If you move to the next slide, it's just an indication of the meningitis belt. You can see the sort of the geographical area that we're talking about. Within the red line is the areas which have a high epidemic risks, and you can see it extends from Gambia and Senegal on the west coast all the way across through to Sudan and Ethiopia, but many other countries in between affected. And you can see a large number of countries that have, if not all their country, a small area of their country where they're affected by very high rates of meningitis and predominantly meningitis type A. If we go to the next slide, here's again from this paper by Halperin this year, looking at the number of meningitis deaths in the African meningitis belt over a number of years. You can see that the years involved go from 2007 through to 2011. Now, I guess we have to really just take this slide as a bit of an indication, because many of the surveillance systems for identifying deaths from meningitis may be somewhat incomplete in that part of the world. But the key thing for me is that the number of deaths are in the thousands. Along the vertical axis, you can see in 2009, over 80,000 deaths from meningitis. So an absolutely phenomenal number of people dying from meningitis. And you'll remember if the mortality rate is 5 or 10% in that order, the number of people actually affected by meningitis, the number of people who may have long-term complications from meningitis are going to be significantly higher than that again. So it's the part of the world where meningitis is most prevalent and where they have the most severe disease. If you go to the next slide, just a bit more data about the range of disease that's occurring. So you'll note that these are from 2007 to 2011, although the 2011 data is not absolutely complete. In each country, this is from across the meningitis belt, in each country about 10% of all the cases have been sampled and tested for serogrouping. As a bit of to give an indication of what proportion of disease is due to the various serogroups. You'll see that for the first 3 years of the survey, serogroup A was by far the greatest amount, the highest proportion of disease. There was a little bit of serogroup W135 and a small proportion of others, but not very much. Then in 2010 and 2011, a much more prominent serogroup W135 and group A, serogroup A and W135 are the two that are causing most of the disease. If we go on to the next slide, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the meningitis vaccine project. So this is a global response to the recognition that meningitis in Africa is a severe public health problem, and this was identified over many, many years, but it wasn't until 2001 that there was a collaboration formed or introduced, which was called the Meningitis Vaccine Project. It's a collaboration between a number of NGOs, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation put a lot of money into this, PATH from Seattle and the World Health Organization were all behind this project, with the objective of following and preventing meningitis deaths in this region of the world. This is an enormous exercise. And they initially started by developing a meningococcal vaccine, and you'll remember that the cost of this is enormous, the number of people that need to be vaccinated is enormous, and the logistics of the rollout are absolutely enormous. But to start with, they really need to get a conjugate vaccine that could be used. And the first trials for this started back in 2005, so 4 years after the meningitis vaccine project was put underway. It was produced in India by the Serum Institute of India, and it's called MenAfricaVax is the trade name for it. It's a conjugate meningococcal A vaccine. Authorization for this was first obtained in India in 2009, and then the World Health Organization came to the party and introduced pre-qualification of the vaccine prior to any efficacy being proven, and this was fast-tracked through their processes and was available in 2010. They have support from Gavi, which is the Global Alliance of Vaccine Initiative, and at the up until very recently, they would fund 30 cents per vaccine dose for operational costs, and in June 2012 they doubled that essentially up to 65 cents for operational costs to increase the rollout of the vaccine. On the next slide, so this is a single dose conjugate vaccine administered to from children who are 1 year of age through to young adults 29, who are the age group most affected by meningococcal disease. The cost per vaccine is 40 cents per dose, which is incredibly cheap. Just to put that in context, I know someone who paid for meningococcal disease, meningococcal vaccine here in New Zealand recently for their child, and it was $100, not available on the fund at the moment. So, and that's New Zealand and US dollars, I think, are very similar at the moment. So incredibly cheap, and it had to be. And the rollout is the thing that really astounds me. Burkina Faso, one of the first countries to be involved in the rollout of this meningococcal A vaccine, they had a 10-day national campaign and over 11 million people were vaccinated. Absolutely incredible. So in that first campaign in 2010, there was a rollout in Burkina Faso, parts of Mali and Niger. In 2011, the remaining parts of Mali and Niger had vaccination campaigns, and then it moved on to Chad, Cameroon, Nigeria. And there were planned rollouts in 2012 for Benin, Ghana, Senegal, and Sudan. So gradually, the meningitis vaccine project is implementing mass vaccination campaigns across the meningitis belt. And if you go on to the next slide, it's a little early to be assessing how effective the vaccine has been, although there are ongoing assessments of that, and that data, I guess, will be out in the coming years. But this is from an up-to-date news digest from the MVP. To date, not a single case of Group A meningitis has been notified in more than 54 million individuals who received the MenAfricaVax in 2010-11. So it looks like it's going to be an incredibly successful vaccine campaign, but we're still waiting to really see the implications of that data, of that vaccination campaign. I guess tempering that, as you'll see from the previous graph, you could see that serogroup W135 was starting to become prominent. Now, there have been outbreaks of W135 disease in that region in previous years, so it doesn't necessarily mean that disease is going to replace A and Group A disease, but I guess that's a worry that it might. But despite all that, it's a remarkable achievement in a global sense, and far greater than any vaccine rollout that's ever been done before, and it's absolutely phenomenal. So I'm going to switch now from Africa to something that's a bit more close to home for myself anyway. If you look on the next slide, you'll see I've circled New Zealand down the bottom of the world there. And just a reminder that New Zealand has predominantly Group B disease, and which has been causing epidemics. And I'll go through just over the next few slides some details about the recent epidemic in New Zealand and how it was controlled with a specific vaccine designed just for New Zealand. On the next slide is something I've cut out of a national magazine, North and South, in New Zealand, that was in, I think, a couple of years ago. And on the cover of this particular edition was a picture of this young lady who had had meningococcal disease when she was an infant and had lost a substantial part of all four of her limbs and clearly came very close to dying in the process. And this is really an article looking at why people still aren't responsive to vaccination campaigns and why a small proportion of generally reasonably wealthy parents choose not to vaccinate their children when clearly vaccination has had a big impact on meningococcal disease in New Zealand. On the next slide is an outline of what's happened in New Zealand in recent years, going back to the early 1990s when I was beginning my training in paediatrics. This data is all from the ESR, which is the government sort of central labs that monitor and all the central or the reporting of meningococcal disease in the country. All the isolates from laboratories around the country are sent to the ESR for typing, so they know exactly the sorts of serogroups that are causing disease. If we look back in 1990, you'll see that the number of cases, the number of isolates in New Zealand per year was below 50, and there was a variety of different serogroups that were causing disease. However, as things progressed through the 1990s, the rates went up dramatically, up to six times higher than the baseline. You can see the other point is that much of the disease is serogroup B disease, and in fact, much of it is a specific subgroup of that, the P1.7B,4 subgroup, so a special type of serogroup B disease. And by the end of the 1990s, that specific subgroup of serogroup B was causing well over 90% of all disease, which is a fairly unique situation globally. Some of the communities, just in comparison to what's going on in Africa, you can see the numbers of disease are much, much lower, but we're obviously a much smaller population in New Zealand. But in some populations, the rates of disease were getting up to as high as would be occurring in the meningitis belt in Africa. On the next slide, you can see that the age groups affected by the disease, the highest rates of disease are in children less than one, slightly lower in older childhood. Many countries will see a blip in the adolescence rates of disease before showing reasonably low rates of disease in adults. So it's young infants who are most at risk of invasive meningococcal disease. The other point to note is that there's an ethnic difference in New Zealand. So the European population in the white bars, the Māori or indigenous population in New Zealand are in the black bars, and New Zealand has a reasonably significant portion of Pacific Island people and a very, very high rates in Pacific Island people in all age groups, the highest rates of anyone. If you look to the next slide, you can see there's a geographical distribution. For those who aren't familiar with New Zealand or with Christchurch, Jane and I are sitting down in the South Island, the lower of the two big islands, and about halfway up on the east coast is Canterbury, and Christchurch is the major city sitting in Canterbury. So that's where we are. And you can see that meningococcal disease in Canterbury didn't have enormously high rates. The places with enormously high rates of disease were predominantly in the North Island, predominantly in South Auckland, and in up the far north in Northland as well. Now, the proportions of children in these areas who are either of Māori or Pacific Island descent are substantially higher than in other parts of the country, and so the rates of disease clearly has a relationship to the ethnicity mix in those populations. In the Pacific Island, children less than 1 year, 1 year of age at the time, it was for children less than 1 year, there was a risk of about every 1 in 100 children who were of Pacific Island descent would be admitted to hospital with meningococcal disease. So this was a severe epidemic. The other thing that really has to be commented on is this is a disease of poverty in New Zealand, and many of these families are living below the poverty line and in overcrowded houses and in situations that are not optimal. So it's not only a disease that epidemiologically followed if it was different on ethnicity backgrounds, but also in terms of poverty as well. If we go on the next slide, the main problem with this epidemic is there's no serogroup B vaccine. There was no licensed polysaccharide vaccine, but even if there were polysaccharide vaccines, the issue with them had been that really there was poor immunogenicity, so people didn't mount in trials adequate immune responses. And there's also this worry about, because some of the serogroup B polysaccharides are similar to those found in the body, that there may be some induction of autoantibodies if these vaccines were used. Globally, there were development of group A vaccines and C vaccines that were polysaccharide vaccines available, but these weren't going to be useful in this situation where almost all the disease in New Zealand was serogroup B. So we had a problem. We needed a new solution for this. What had been done elsewhere in the world is, instead of polysaccharide vaccines, people had developed specific outer membrane vesicle vaccines for clonal outbreaks, and this seemed to fit the bill for New Zealand, really. And four of the countries that had done this previously included Chile, Brazil, Cuba, and Norway. On the next slide, I've to show what I mean by outer membrane vesicles. Here's on the left here, you've got a picture of the diplococcus, the meningococcus, and you can see little tiny blebs coming off the surface of the organism, and these are what we used for the vaccine. And it basically contains surface proteins, lipopolysaccharide, other polysaccharides as well, and was found to be highly immunogenic. They washed them with detergent to get rid of the lipopolysaccharide. But the thing with these vaccines is they are very specific for an individual serotype of organism. So in general, not very good for large outbreaks or where there's a country that needs a variety of different things. But for New Zealand, they're exactly what we needed. So on the next slide, this is a paper published in 2004 with many of the key players in developing this vaccine or promoting this vaccine listed. And basically, they've described it as a tailor-made vaccine to combat a devastating epidemic, and that's exactly what it was. So the vaccine, as I said, is an outer membrane protein vaccine. It was established in collaboration with a vaccine company and a Norwegian group, and it was called MensB, with the trademark used for it. And basically, it was used in combination with a comprehensive vaccine strategy to look at the immunogenicity, the safety of this vaccine, at the same time as rolling it out across the country as rapidly as possible. And so they were able to test it in adults, children, and young infants, and ultimately ended up being introduced onto the national immunisation schedule for New Zealand as part of the infant immunisation. One of the positive spin-offs from this was that to do all this, they needed to have a national immunisation register developed. And so at the end of all this vaccination campaign, New Zealand was left with a fantastic way of monitoring ongoing vaccination coverage in the country as well. So it was a specific vaccine for a specific strain. And if we go to the next page, we can have a look at the effect of the vaccine in New Zealand. So again, this is similar to the previous graph, but gone on a few years after the introduction of the vaccine. You can see in the dark blue is the specific group B with the P1.4 subgrouping. And then the grey stuff is the other group B disease, and you see a tiny amount of group C disease, but almost exclusively group B disease. And on the right-hand side, you can see the vaccine coverage and the proportions of children who had had three doses. So starting off in December 2004 with only 12%, moving up rapidly to 78% coverage in December 2005, and by the end of December 2006, reasonably high coverage, and in particularly in areas with high rates of disease, where there was concentrated efforts to get all the children vaccinated. And that pretty much led to a reduction in meningococcal disease, and it stopped the epidemic in its tracks. Now, it's possible, we can't prove that it was vaccine-related effect, it's possible that the epidemic would have gone away anyway, but it seems likely that the vaccine had a substantial effect. And it certainly had an effect on the specific clone that was designed to reduce the amount of disease for. Subsequently, we have taken that off the vaccine schedule. The men's B vaccine has been taken off because the amount of meningococcal disease has gone down substantially. But we have it kept in reserve if there was a resurgence of that particular serotype. Okay, so that's Group B disease specific to New Zealand, but there's lots of different sorts of Group B disease, and that the vaccine I've described wouldn't really be able to be used elsewhere in the world. So if you move to the next slide, people have looked at using other things other than a polysaccharide capsule for disease and for producing vaccines. And you can see I've circled a number of different proteins in the outer membrane of this organism that would have been targeted because they've been found by a process of what we call reverse vaccinology, whereby people have gone to the genome of the meningococcus and tried to identify genes that produce proteins that may be immunogenic, and then after testing whole hundreds of different proteins have ended up with three or four that are immunogenic and have subsequently become part of the meningococcal B vaccine. And I've just circled a few that would be there. The next slide is just a pretty picture, again, just to show you how these fit in, these membrane proteins fit in, and the three in colour there are three of the ones that are introduced in one of the vaccine. Just note the top of the organism, it's got the polysaccharide capsule, which looks very pretty on the outside. I just thought I'd throw that in. So there are a number of different vaccine candidates for Group B disease, because clearly it's been a priority. And if you just move to the next slide, I'm just going to talk about one of them, which is the 4C MenB vaccine. It has a trade name, but I'm not going to go into that today. This is a new approach to meningococcal B disease, whereby instead of having what we had in the New Zealand case, one specific vaccine, scientists have combined a number of different of these surface proteins in the one vaccine, and you can see them listed down the bottom. So those are the three proteins that I've showed you on those pictures. And then in addition to that, they've included the outer membrane vesicle from the New Zealand strain as well in this MenC4B vaccine. So this is one of several different vaccines, but I really include it because it's the one that's is the furthest on in clinical trials. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see this is not licensed as yet, but there are phase 2 studies showing good immunogenicity in infants and adolescents. It seems that it can be given safely to infants along with other vaccines. And it's really hard to have a good way to estimate the coverage of this vaccine should it be introduced. And this is company-sponsored, but the main estimates around that it's suggestive that it might cover nearly up to 80% of serogroup B isolates. So it looks very promising. It's hopefully going to be coming on the market not too far away, and some of the preliminary data is reasonably good. So it may be that we have a universal meningococcal B vaccine that may be able to be used around the world. And on the next slide, here's an editorial from the JMA, which I think describes this really appropriately. So we're inching towards a serogroup B meningococcal vaccine for infants. And in this paper, they've commented on a paper in the journal that's really demonstrated that you can use this MenC4B vaccine alongside other infant vaccines at the same time, and the side effect profile and the immunogenicity is exactly the same as if you were using them separately. So that's really encouraging. And I think we're just, it'll be a little bit of time before this is available, but we are heading towards in the right direction. So I just thought we'd stop there and move on to other. We've done A, we've done B, and I thought we'd move on to other vaccines around the world that are being used. And I'll go back to this on the next slide, the map. You can see that just want to focus in on the American market, North America and South America. You can see that if you had a vaccine against Group B, you'd cover a substantial proportion, but by no means all of the meningococcal disease. So really we need something more. And on the next slide, you can see that I've included the vaccines that are around and available to be used at the moment and licensed. you can see that there are available combination polysaccharide vaccines, and they've been around for a wee while, which are quadrivalent with four different serotypes included. And there's two of those available, certainly in New Zealand. And then the conjugate vaccines, again, that have been around for a while. I haven't listed absolutely all of them, just a smattering to give you an example. But the key things are that there's Group C vaccines on their own, which have been implemented in various countries around the world, and I'll show you in a second. But also there are quadrivalent vaccines that are developed, and these are all conjugate vaccines that provide long-lasting immunity. On the next slide, just to go through Men's C vaccine, which was in the UK, was introduced back in 1999, one of the first vaccines to meningococcal vaccines to be introduced. It's a really interesting story that I don't have time to go into today, but about it was introduced without efficacy data, so without knowing that the vaccine would work, but just knowing that it was immunogenic and produced an immune response, it was able to be licensed, and that's the first time that was really done for a vaccine. In the UK, it was initially induced in a three-dose schedule at 2, 3, and 4 months in infants. And if you look on the next slide, you'll see that it's been enormously successful at eliminating Group C disease. So the vaccine was, this is again data from the HPA, which is the Health Protection Agency, which looks at all the data from meningococcal disease across the UK and Ireland. If you look at the graph, you can see there are ongoing epidemics every year, or outbreaks, I should say, of every year of meningococcal disease, mostly related to winter months. And Group C disease was initially a substantial proportion of that. When the vaccine was introduced in 1999, you can see within 2 years the rates of disease were dropping, the number of cases were dropping and dropping. And nowadays, it's almost unheard of to get a Group C Neisseria meningitis disease in infants in the UK. But there hasn't been any effect on serogroup B disease, which is still the prominent one, which is now the prominent one, I should say. And in fact, what they have noticed is that there's started to be an increase in Group Y disease, which hasn't been seen anywhere. So those are small numbers, but it'll be very interesting to see from a public health point of view where the UK go to next. Do they decide to continue just using Men's C vaccine, or do they need something that covers serogroup B as well, or do they go down the route of having a quadrivalent vaccine? On the next slide, just some data from Canada, just showing a similar sort of thing, really. Serogroup C meningococcal disease in Quebec, and you can see this where it goes from 2001 through to 2008, and you can see with the introduction of meningococcal C vaccine in the young age groups and in the older age groups as well, within a couple of years of the introduction of the vaccine, substantial reductions in the rates of disease in all age groups related to meningococcal vaccine implementation. So meningococcal C vaccine is been around for a significant period of time now, and there's a lot of data showing it's a very effective vaccine. But where do we go to next? As I've alluded to, you can see that we're sort of covering one particular serogroup each time in various countries. That's usually obviously the one that's causing most disease. But some of the countries have a lot of different serogroups, and what we do next is really, I guess, moving on to a quadrivalent vaccine. So onto the next slide, the quadrivalent vaccines clearly have four different sorts of serogroups covered, but unfortunately at this stage don't have any Group B antigens included in there, so it would cover everything other than Group B. And they're ideal for countries where the disease is caused by a number of different serogroups. I guess the issue is that they are expensive vaccines, and at this stage countries are needing to make difficult decisions about how much they're going to cost and what can they afford to be on a national schedule, and certainly that's where New Zealand is at the moment, whereby the introduction of a quadrivalent vaccine in New Zealand would probably be far too expensive to introduce at this time. However, in wealthy countries like the US, and if we move on to the next slide, they have been introduced and quite successfully. So this is a recommendation from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices in the US from 2010, and they recommended that from January 2011 that the conjugate quadrivalent meningococcal vaccine should be offered to all persons between the ages of 2 and 55 years at increased risk of meningococcal disease. You know, they haven't gone for children under 2, and that's because I guess they're waiting for immunogenicity data for children who are under 2. Then they recommend that all adolescents should be vaccinated with this vaccine at 11 years of age, and that adolescents should receive a booster at 16 years of age to give them coverage through their young adult life. So I think this is the way, certainly in wealthy countries around the world, I think this is the way that the control of meningococcal disease is heading. I think it's a long way off before these vaccines can produce cheaply enough to be used in resource-poor countries, and I guess that's an ongoing issue. But it certainly looks like there's certainly been a successful introduction into the US, and we're awaiting complete data on how effective the vaccines have been in terms of reducing the amount of meningococcal disease in that country. So just the final slide. Firstly, meningococcal disease is a serious disease. It causes a higher rate of mortality and severe morbidity when it does attack, and it's a scary disease because it happens rapidly, and often, even if treatment is available, people succumb before they get to hospital. But it is a preventable disease. We've got new vaccines in development. We've got meningococcal B vaccines coming through, which look highly promising. And I hope to have brought across to you today that with collaborative efforts around the world, actually the production of such vaccines for resource-poor countries is not beyond the realms of possibility. And in fact, in the meningitis belt at the moment, that's exactly what's happening. And I guess it might be, you would hope for in the future, that if we were able to control meningococcal A disease, but there were outbreaks of W135 disease, that maybe in those resource-poor countries that there might be production of vaccines that would cover that as well. However, a note of caution that it's all very well to have the vaccines available, but actually the implementation into routine schedules is not as easy as it sounds. And it's going to depend on a lot of different things, which will vary between countries. It'll depend on the rates of disease in specific countries, the cost, the acceptability, and how these vaccines fit into the schedules. But it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the coming years. Okay, thank you all very much for your time.
That's excellent, thank you. I think you've really given us a fantastic overview from a very global insight, which will be really great interest, I think, to our telecast listeners on meningococcal disease globally. And I think particularly of interest to me was obviously the New Zealand focus, but also the awareness of the African campaign, how effective that was. And do you think that the stopping of the New Zealand vaccination at 80% compliance was a good point to stop it, or would it be preferable to see it continue for a while after that in terms of coverage and making sure the disease doesn't reoccur?
I think that's a difficult question, and again it comes down to resources locally. I think the Ministry of Health had decided that the rates of disease had dropped so low that it was an expensive campaign and they could no longer justify having that on our schedule. The other thing was it was three injections, separate injections for all the babies. So in addition to the routine vaccinations, they got an additional three vaccines. So it's a sort of thing that really only could be possibly introduced in a severe epidemic. And having it on a routine schedule, unless it's somehow in the future combined with other vaccines, is a major problem, really. So there's some real difficult decisions around that, but I think ultimately it was the cost of the ongoing campaign and the fact that the rates of disease had dropped substantially and the epidemic was over that led them to decide that we couldn't continue to vaccinate children that way.
So do you envisage an eventual elimination of the disease to really low levels, or will that never happen because of the variety of serotypes globally?
I suspect we'll have the vaccines to do that, It's the implementation. Clearly in wealthy countries it could happen, but these vaccines are reasonably expensive, aside from the African vaccine, and until they can be brought down to an affordable price in many countries, that's going to be the issue. Affordability and implementation are the key thing. So it's all very well to have the vaccines there, but actually getting them introduced. And New Zealand's a good example of that. I think you'd struggle to get a meningococcal vaccine on the schedule in New Zealand just because the rates of disease have dropped so low and there are other priorities. So it may be that we choose to use rotavirus vaccine or chickenpox vaccine, which we don't have in New Zealand, in preference to a meningococcal vaccine. So there are some really tricky resource implication decisions, really, around that sort of thing. So it would be nice to think that we could, but I think it's going to be there's plenty of challenges to doing that.
Well, maybe we'll get you back in a couple of years to update us as another teleclass. That's great. Well, thank you again for your contribution, and thank you to the listeners who've called in today to listen to today's weather training teleclass. You'll see on your very final slide that the last South Pacific teleclass series features Professor Sito from Hong Kong, who has contributed to this series several times in the past, so it'll be lovely to have him back again, and this time he's going to be talking about infection control for renal dialysis, and that's a WHO teleclass. So thank you very much for listening in, and from all of us here in New Zealand, I'll talk to you again. Bye-bye.